I'm Allison Keyes. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. We're going to talk about the lives of some people who have been tested. That's the name of a book about 12 men who did hard time for crimes they didn't commit. That's coming up later in the program. But first, to the long-running story of apparent government discrimination against Black and Native American farmers. Late on Friday, the U.S. Senate approved more than $4.5 billion to pay for settlements in the cases. Much of that money had been blocked by procedural moves in the Senate, leaving the farmers waiting for money they say has been decades coming. Joining me to talk about the funding are Jefferson Keel, Lieutenant Governor of the Chickasaw Nation and President of the National Congress of American Indians. And in the studio with me is John Boyd, President of the National Black Farmers Association. Thanks, gentlemen, for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let me start with John, since he's sitting here in my face. You once drove your tractor 280 miles from Virginia to emphasize the need to fund these settlements. How are you feeling today?
Well, I think I'm a whole lot better than I was when I was driving my tractor up Highway number one for certain. But this has been just a long struggle for the Black farmers and for the Cobell case as well. It's been going on for decades. And basically to have a bill come to the floor 10 times, last Friday was the 10th time. And we were able to work out differences with Senator Coburn and other Republicans. And Chuck Grassley really did a good job reaching out to other Republicans and making sure, trying to get them on board. And Leader Reed, who done a good job at finally mending the fences there so that this bill could pass by unanimous consent, which is very, very hard to do in the Senate.
Remind us of why the Black farmers are being paid.
Well, this is a discrimination case. And these cases are very, very old. They go back to 1981 to 1997. And our case was first filed in federal court back in the early 80s, and we kept filing that case in federal court until we had some success with Judge Freeman in 1997. That case was settled out of court by a consent decree where Black farmers were supposed to receive $50,000 per farmer. And here we are in the year 2010 still trying to get restitution till tens of thousands of Black farmers who never had their cases heard based on its merit.
And this was about loans, the way...
This is about loans, access to the U.S. Farm Subsidy Program, where Black farmers were totally shut out of the Farm Lending Program, where it takes 387 days to process a Black loan request and less than 30 days to process a white loan request, where large-scale corporate farmers and white farmers receive on average, $1 million per farmer in the U.S. Farm Subsidy Program and less than $200 to Black farmers. So we have some very, very wide disparate figures that go right along with this issue.
Jefferson Keel, let me ask you about the American Indian farmers' issues with the government.
Well, similar to the Pigford lawsuit, which is just talked about, the same type of actions were taken, and we're just happy that the Congress has seen fit to move these things forward, and they're finally getting to the point where they are receiving, they will be able to receive the restitution that they're entitled to.
For the American Indian farmers, though, it isn't about loans, is it? It's about mineral rights?
It's about mineral rights and the mismanagement of those accounts, and many of those access to having those rights, and so there's some similarities, though.
How long ago did the discrimination go in the American Indians cases, Jefferson?
Well, it goes back decades, and in fact, even in the Cobell settlement, when Eloise Cobell filed her suit in 1996, that included hundreds of individuals, more than 300,000 individual Indians, and so all of those claims and all of these suits have some similarities, but it's all about discrimination and mismanagement, and finally getting to the point where we can reconcile many of those differences.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes, and we're speaking about the billions that have been approved to fund settlements over government discrimination lawsuits by African-American and Native American farmers. We're joined by John Boyd of the Black Farmers Association and Jefferson Keel of the National Congress of American Indians. And I want to ask both of you, John first, isn't this coming way too late for some of the people involved in this?
It's coming way too late, and the Indians have two cases, the Cobell case and the Keepsicle case, which is against the Department of Agriculture. But this is it's just taking too long. You know, black farmers have died at the plow, waiting for this justice to happen, and many have died, and I find myself going to more funerals than to farmer meetings, something that should be doing more of it, but we actually go into these funerals. And that was one of the reasons why we took the settlement. We wanted $2.5 billion and we settled for $1.25 billion because we thought that this process would be put on fast track. And we just hit so many bumps in the road, within the Senate. The bill passed twice in the House, and we thought that it would pass quickly in the Senate and, from February till almost, the end of November, and we're just now getting out of the Senate. So this has been a very, very long process, and we're heading into another year. And I'm hopeful that when Congress comes back and after our Thanksgiving, that we'll be able to put this on fast track and work with leaders and in the House and, to actually get this done.
Jefferson, what have the Native American farmers been doing while they're waiting for this to be settled?
Well, along the same lines, the comments you just heard are similar. They're almost exact. As you just heard, it's been such a long time coming and such a painful process. We're just happy that we're finally at a point where we can work with Congress, and I'm happy to say that Congress has finally moved these things forward. But we're finally at a point where we have the ability to have the president sign these things into law so that those individuals can finally start to receive the compensation or the restitution that they deserve. And it has been such a long, painful process. And people have been suffering during this process.
John, let me ask you, break down how this money is going to be paid out. Does everyone get $50,000? And we're talking about the farmers who missed the deadline for the first round of payments, right?
Yes, we're talking about, in the black farmers' case, the farmers that missed the deadline, which is tens of thousands, upward towards 80,000 black farmers that actually missed the filing deadline. And each one of those cases are going to be heard based on his or her merits by an individual arbitrator. That's not something I wanted, but that is the procedure. And it's similar to the same setup that we had in the first settlement, but we don't have to go out and find what's called a similarly situated white farmer. The farmer just had the previous case, and they would get it up and down. And if it's successful, they will receive their money. And then if not, they would not be compensated. So it's still a little bit of a process, but we wanted justice. And that's what this case was about, vindication and justice. The amount of money would never bring back the millions of acres of land that we lost in this discrimination. It won't bring back our farms and things of this nature. So we've lost a lot of farmers and we've lost a lot of land in this process.
Does that mechanism help allay the concerns of some of those who are still worried about this? I mean, there's an Iowa congressman, Steve King, who said he's questioning whether the black farmers involved in this settlement deserve it.
And he always has. Steve King has always questioned this issue. But I'm hopeful that leaders and both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, will work together the way that they did in the Senate and put aside their differences. And there's really nothing to investigate. Maybe we need to be investigating the farm subsidy program and why black farmers can't receive subsidies and investigating the farm programs and why black farmers can't get loans. Maybe that's the kind of investigation that we need to be looking at versus putting on hold a group of people who have proven their case in federal court, that have a settlement agreement on the table. We've done everything right. And for them to ask to come up at the last minute and try to block this, I think is a disgrace to the black farmers and everybody involved.
Jefferson, let me ask you to break down the settlement for the Native Americans. There's a trust fund and a scholarship fund as well, right?
Yes. Well, under the agreement that was reached, I believe there's about $680 million that'll be made available to for compensation for the members for discrimination claims. There's also about $80 million in a debt forgiveness portion of that, and that'll prevent some foreclosures. And I'm not real sure, to be honest with you, how many of those people are eligible, you know, to until after that those claims are made and there's another hearing that will be held.
Jefferson, let me break in and just ask you, if this gets delayed again, what happens to your people?
Well, hopefully we won't see that. To be honest with you, we'll just have to go back to the drawing board. But we'll just have to continue to go back to Congress and go through the. We hope that we won't have to go through this process again. But hopefully it won't be delayed. I believe there's going to be a hearing in April, and hopefully we'll have some resolution at that time.
Okay, John, really briefly,
yes.
Do the problems that started this still exist? Are you still having issues getting loans? And I mean briefly.
Yes, I would like to work on that at the Department of Agriculture. And it's something that after we finalize the settlement, we're going to refocus our efforts and double our efforts to make sure that all farmers can take part, Indians, Hispanics, Blacks, small farmers can take part in all of these USDA programs. It's very, very important to me.
Are you very worried that this could be held up again?
Well, I'm hopeful that it won't. I mean, we certainly laid all of the right groundworks here, and we're hopeful that we set the right tone in the Senate where Congress can work together with Republicans and Democrats to get this done.
Jefferson Keel is president of the National Congress of American Indians and joined us by phone. And John Boyd is president of the National Black Farmers Association, sitting right here in our studios in Washington. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the story of a Maryland secretary who found out she'd been named the first female king of a tribe in Ghana, but first to the troubled country of Haiti. Presidential elections are less than a week away there, and Haitians wonder if anyone can lead one of the world's most troubled nations out of its despair. Cholera is the latest crisis. An outbreak of the fast-moving disease has claimed an estimated 1,250 lives. 21,000 are said to be infected. The numbers have increased dramatically in the last week. Last week, unrest broke out in the country's north. Crowds attacked UN peacekeeping troops from Nepal, who they claim are responsible for the cholera outbreak. For the latest on the situation, we're joined by Sophie Delaunay, executive director of the aid group Doctors Without Borders USA, and Associated Press reporter Jonathan Katz, who's in Miami on his way back to Port-au-Prince. Welcome to both of you to Tell Me More.
Thanks for having me, Allison.
Jonathan, let me start with you. I mean, the streets are still full of rubble from the earthquake 10 months ago. There are more than a million people living in tents, and now there's supposed to be an election. What's it like there?
It's extremely difficult, which is pretty much a constant state of being in Haiti. But right now, until the last couple of days, it wasn't even 100% for sure that the elections were going to go ahead. But at this point, it looks like it's full steam ahead for Sunday. And essentially, it's just a very difficult situation on political and health care and every other level in Haiti.
Is there actual campaigning going on in the midst of all this?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Candidates are holding big rallies and going down the streets and neighborhoods and towns and going out to the countryside and rallying. There's a lot of posters going up. If you go anywhere in Port-au-Prince, you see big billboards with candidates' faces smiling back to you and posters covering the walls. So yeah, it's very much election time down there.
Sophie, I've read that some of the candidates have been concerned that they and perhaps the people attending their rallies could be in danger because of the cholera outbreak. Is that a possibility?
Well, I'm not sure that it's actually true that people would be in danger, although I've heard some of the aid groups talk about how having mass gatherings with people is a possible way of spreading the disease if sanitation is bad and people are coming into contact with one another. But from my understanding, it's very hard to spread cholera really from person to person or casual contact. But it is true that the candidates, a number of them have been concerned about that. And that sort of reflects how new cholera is in Haiti and a lot of the I don't want to say ignorance, but confusion that surrounds the disease. People don't exactly know how to manage it, and so a lot of the candidates are, are wondering if they need to be campaigning differently in order to keep it from spreading.
Sophie, do people there understand what's happening with this disease? And should they be worried about gathering in large crowds?
Well, I think that, you know, cholera is a disease that always carries a lot of anxiety and stigma. So there is definitely a need in Haiti these days for more public communication, reassuring the population that is frightened by the disease and explaining what the risks are of transmission, but also what the benefits of a proper response.
I know Doctors Without Borders had said over the weekend that the other aid groups needed to step up their response there. What do you mean by that?
Well, what we mean is that, you know, since the first cases were declared mid-October, the response has come, you know, too late, too slow and much too small from what we've experienced in our 21 cholera treatment center. You know, we are stretched to capacity out of the 21,000, I think, the last figures you reported, Alison. We've treated more than 18,000 cases so far. So treatment is one crucial and key aspect of the addressing cholera, but there are a lot of different pillars, especially in the prevention side, that needs to be covered in order for the treatment to be efficient and for not sending people back to contaminated areas.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes, and we're speaking about Haiti's elections and how they are dealing with that amidst an outbreak of cholera. I'm joined by Sophie Delaunay of Doctors Without Borders USA and Jonathan Katz, Port-au-Prince reporter for the Associated Press. Sophie, have aid organizations there been able to resume operations? I know they were suspended for a bit this weekend after the demonstrations.
There are some operations going on. We have been able to continue our operations on the treatment side, but the operations need to be scaled up definitely. There is a need for, as we say, more public communication. There is a need for provision of safe chlorinated water, particularly in highly concentrated areas. There is a need for more latrines to be built, for better waste removal system. I understand, and we also face a lot of constraints on the ground, but there's definitely a need for more response.
Jonathan, the demonstrations were mostly against those Nepalese peacekeepers from the UN because there's the circumstantial evidence that that is the source of the cholera. Is that right?
That was a major factor in the demonstrations. Yeah, there's a lot of anger surrounding those rumors.
How much science is backing up the concerns that people have that this disease was brought in from the peacekeepers?
Well, it's a kind of a difficult question to answer, and part of the reason for that is that there hasn't really been thorough sort of investigation that even a lot of public health experts, scientists, epidemiologists have been asking for. It is absolutely the fact that there is a lot of circumstantial evidence, as you said. Basically, the outbreak occurred in a remote rural part of the country along a river, that there aren't a lot of foreigners living, but there are foreigners there who are UN peacekeepers. And the strain was found to be a strain that originated in South Asia, and there's a number of other things as well. And so essentially there has been a lack of inquiry for most of the time since these rumors surfaced in the weeks that the cholera outbreak has been going on. But what we've seen is that as the evidence mounts, the head of the United Nations peacekeeping mission told us a couple days ago that he's taking these suspicions very seriously. I think they've moved from the realm of rumor into suspicion or even well-founded allegation.
Sophie, wait, let me bring in Sophie here and ask, are there efforts to try and determine exactly where this infection came from?
Yes, I know that some people on the ground are working on that. I also know that the Center for Disease Control is working on that. As Jonathan said, experts have not pinpointed the origin of Haiti's epidemic yet, but the strain that we found is similar to strains from South Asia, but also is similar to some strains found in recent cholera outbreaks. In 2009, we had major cholera outbreak in Zimbabwe and Zambia, and more recently in 2010, these are the strains we found in Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger in Western Africa. So, you know, this is difficult to find the origin, but we find some similar cases throughout the world.
Jonathan, really, really briefly, if it turns out that this evidence is correct, what does that do to the reputation of the peacekeepers there? And I mean really briefly.
Right. There's two parts of it. If they're found to have brought cholera, then there's going to be an angry reaction on a lot of people's part. But as people have told us, the United Nations' reticence to investigate itself up until this point has also created a negative reaction because people feel that they're not being accountable.
All right. We will be watching what happens and Tell Me More. We'll keep covering this. Sophie Delaunay is Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders USA, and Jonathan Katz reports for the Associated Press. Thank you both for an update on this continually disturbing story.
Thanks, Alison.
And now we turn to NPR's West Africa correspondent, Ophebia Quist Arkton, who's here in Washington for a brief visit. When she's here, Tell Me More likes to see if we can't take a peek into her reporter's notebook, a chance to ask her about some of the stories she's been covering recently. And we've asked her, too, to fill us in on one of the most anticipated world music festivals in Africa. Ophebia joins us now from Studio 4B. Welcome.
Always a pleasure to be with Tell Me More.
Ophebia, what's that cool drumming we hear in the background?
The drumming is for the king, and the drumming is for the late king, whose funeral we were attending in Ocham, a fishing village in central Ghana.
Apparently, a woman from here in Maryland actually got a call one morning and had to move to Ghana, and now she's a king.
Well, she's still here. She's got a foot on each continent. She's a secretary at the Ghana Embassy here in Washington, D.C., and she's also a royal, a king, looking after 7,000 fishermen, farmers, and a community in Ghana.
Who is she, and how did she get to be king?
Peggy Lean Bartels is her name. She's 57 years old, and she got a call, as you said, at 4 a.m. She said, you know, she was exhausted. She was going off to work, and she thought people were joking. They said Nana, and Nana in Twi and Fanti in the Akan language means king, royal. And she said, look, don't joke with me. Hey, I'm tired. And they said, no, hold on a moment. Hold on a moment. We have put all the names of possible kings into a hat as such. You pour libation, mm-hmm. which is pouring spirits, and no obvious name came up. Somebody said, no, why don't you put Peggy's name in? And when we poured libation, when we asked your name, the spirits started vaporing. We did it 4 times to be sure, and so we knew
that
you were our
chosen.
New king.
Was she a little surprised?
She said she was absolutely flabbergasted. A king, me, a king. But, you know, I've got my mortgage in the U.S. I've got my responsibilities in the U.S. Of course I visit Ghana. But, you know, being responsible for 7,000 people, that's a tough call.
She herself has said her life has changed a tad since this happened to her. Let's take a listen.
I've lost a lot of friends because they don't want to come around. Not that they hate me, but they feel that, oh, now she's a king. We can't joke around her like we used to joke. We say, you know, all kinds of things. We laughed and we walk and we go shopping. But now I have to have some kind of a respect for the things I do. So they say, well, now her interest is different from our interest. So it's quite a challenge, but I'm not worried about it at all. Because if it's been bestowed on me, I have to go with the responsibilities and respect the traditional ruling.
What are some of the other ways she said her life is different now?
What she wears. You know, she says before if you felt like slouching about, you could slouch about. Now that she's a nana, she's got to always make sure. In the hot weather, she wears a toga-style wrap, which is what kings in Ghana wear, and in wonderful colors, either kente cloth, which is that rich woven cloth, and I was at a funeral for her late uncle where she wore red. But otherwise, she says she always has to look very presentable because, of course, she's now representing a fishing village of 7,000.
Wow. And she's also been getting some help from some donors in the U.S. I know you spoke to Pastor Belouis Colleton from the Shiloh Baptist Church in Landover, Maryland, who went to visit King Peggy with some of the members of his congregation. Here's what he had to say.
We have covenant with Nana, the king, we as a church, to help her to better her community of people by bringing fresh water. And now we are moving towards the possibility of establishing a school and a church edifice for the people here of Otuam, particularly in the Baptist faith.
Briefly, Ophebia, what kind of changes has she brought to her village so far?
Peggy-Lyn Bartels and Shiloh Baptist Stewart and other donors here in the US as well as in Ghana, they've been able to bring fresh water. It is by the Atlantic coast, which is, of course, the Atlantic Ocean, so seawater, but they've dug boreholes so that women and children don't have to walk for miles to go and get fresh water. And they've got an elementary school, but kids have to go away for secondary school education. They want to make sure that they build a high school so that everybody can stay put.
Okay, let's move on to a different topic. This Sunday, the Ivory Coast is holding runoff elections between the two leading presidential candidates. Last year, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton visited the Ivory Coast. Talk to us a little bit about why that is so important to the U.S.
Stability. Stability. Ivory Coast used to be a bastion of stability and also prosperity in West Africa. It's a cocoa-growing nation, the top cocoa-exporting nation in the world. And it had never had a coup d'etat, you know, for 40-odd years. And then on Christmas Eve, 1999, the military took over, which threw everyone. A couple of years later, an elected president, but, a not very proper election, and then 2 years later, civil war. That was Ivory Coast, where everyone from the region had come to build the economy. Immigrants from neighboring Burkina Faso, Guinea, Ghana, Nigeria, all over. Suddenly, this strong country was down at its knees. So now, 10 years later, 10 years since they've had their last election, finally, Ivory Coast is going to have this runoff election. The stakes are very high. President Laurent Gbagbo, who's been in power for 10 years now, 5 years unelected because of the civil war, wants to stay in power. And his main adversary, Alassane Ouattara, who was a former prime minister, says, no, I am the man who is going to unite Ivory Coast.
Are there concerns about violence?
Absolutely. Absolutely, because the stakes are so high now. Because of the civil war, because parts of the nation are awash with arms, because not everybody has disarmed. So calls from everywhere, including here in Washington, please hold a peaceful election, that it's the people of Ivory Coast and the future of Ivory Coast that matters, not just being in power.
Switching gears once more to something that I'm so jealous you're getting to go to and I'm not. In December, the Third World Festival of Black Arts and Cultures will take place in Senegal. It's been more than 30 years since the last one was held. Who's in this and why has it taken so long to put another one together?
Well, the first one was in 1966 in Dakar, which, as you know, is my home base. And that was just after independence, Alison. So, you know, there was all that feeling of African nationhood and then Africans and non-Africans from the diaspora coming to Senegal to really celebrate. Then in Nigeria, 10 years later, in Lagos, Festac it was called. And I understand, you know, I was still, no, probably not a schoolgirl, but had just gone to university, but I really wanted to be there. All of Africa and all in the diaspora gathered for music, for culture, for theatre. And why has it taken so long? Because Africans have been too busy fighting wars and doing things that are bringing the continent down. But let's hope that in Senegal, from the 10th to the 31st of December, we're going to enjoy music, culture, and everything good.
On our way out, let's take a listen to a little of Angélique Kidjo, who I believe is going to be one of the people participating in the festival. Ophébia Quist-Arkton is NPR's West Africa correspondent. She joined us from our studios in Washington, and she's got such a cool month ahead for her.
Looking forward to it, and we'll share it with Tell Me More. Thank you.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, we honor the late Margaret Burroughs, a woman who made it her mission to personally bring the story of African-American history to those in her neighborhood, her city, and her nation. But first, America's system of criminal justice is based on the presumption of innocence. It's the burden of police and prosecutors to prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, that a defendant is guilty of a crime. But what happens when that system goes wrong and innocent people find themselves behind bars? How do the wrongly convicted maintain the faith and inner strength required to endure prison, much less fight for their release? A new book explores those questions. It's called Tested, How 12 Wrongly Imprisoned Men Held On to Hope, and we're joined now by one of its authors, former prosecutor and current Episcopal deacon Dorothy Budd. Also with us are two of the men profiled in the book, Billy Smith, who spent more than 19 years in prison for a sexual assault the DNA evidence finally proved he didn't commit, and Christopher Scott, who was wrongfully convicted of capital murder and served 12 years in prison before being exonerated and freed in 2009. All three joined us from Dallas, Texas. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure, and thank you for having me here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. It's our pleasure to be here today.
Dorothy, let me start with you. How did you get involved in this, and how did you meet the men involved?
Well, there were really two things that led to it. First of all, I was a prosecutor in the Dallas County District Attorney's Office working in their sex crime division, and those were the years that many of these cases originated. So as time went by after I quit working for the district attorney's office, still, I would always notice in the paper when someone was being exonerated and look to see if it was one of my cases. And
right.
Probably all I ever would have done was look at it in the paper and think about it, except that my church, the Church of the Incarnation, was having a Bible study with a nearby community. And one day, the question was, where have you seen God's Spirit at work in your lifetime? And an older African-American woman said, well, for me, it was when the new DA got elected in Dallas. And I had no idea where that was going to go and whether it was going to be something political. But when I asked her, she said, no, I'm not talking about politics. I'm talking about the fact that there were this group of innocent men that had been in prison for so long and no one had been hearing their cries. And suddenly both the technology came about to prove their innocence, and there was someone in office who was willing to listen to their cries. So that's how this book came to be and how I went and asked the district attorney if I could meet these amazing men.
Billy, I know this is going to be hard for you, but I'd like you to take us back to the day you were arrested and tell us what happened.
That was, I think, one of the most beautiful mornings I'd ever seen in my life. The sun was shining bright, and it was kind of cool that morning, and I didn't know that that'd be the last morning I would ever see for 19 years. August 7, 1986, I was at my sister's apartment. I spent the night there because I was living with her. And 7 o'clock in the morning, there was a knock on the door, and it was the Dallas Police Department. And they asked me to come out on the back, and they said it was a woman that said that she had been raped about 2:30 the previous morning. And so I said, well, I don't know anything about that. I was in here asleep. And so he told me, he said, well, she has a complaint against you. And then he called downtown to the sergeant. And when they found out that I had been arrested before and I was in parole, then they told him to bring me downtown for further questioning. And so I went out, and I agreed to take a polygraph test. I agreed to take a blood test and everything. Of course, they denied me. You know, I just never thought I would get convicted because I knew I hadn't did anything. So from 35 years old when I was arrested in 1986, and I was 54 years old when I got exonerated and released.
Wow, that's a huge chunk of your life. I want to ask Christopher, and you were wrongfully arrested and convicted of murder, and it wasn't even based on physical evidence, right? I mean, you spent 12 years in prison. Did you ever think earlier, well, there's no evidence against me, so surely they're going to find out that I'm not supposed to be here?
Well, yeah, I thought that at first, but the deck was stacked against me because I'm not a racist person or anything, but my judge was white, my whole jury panel was white, my lawyer was white. You know, I didn't just feel like I didn't have a chance to win at all because we had to pick three different jury panels before we could pick one that would convict me of a crime of capital murder that carried life or death. And a lot of people couldn't say that they could do that because they didn't have no type of evidence at all to prosecute me, even to take it to trial.
Billy, the thing that struck me about reading your story was that you said there was a point that you actually wondered if you had committed the crime. I mean, how does your mind get to that place?
Growing up, I abused alcohol, I abused drugs, and there were those moments when you'd be so high, you pass out and you wake up the next day, you just didn't remember anything.
Right.
And it was like I was sitting in my cell and I was thinking, did I pass out and rape this woman and I just don't remember?
Wow. And Christopher, I know you had kind of a crisis of faith involving the woman that you loved, Brandy. And I have to say, the women that read your story were all like, aw. Talk to us a little bit about how she sustained you, at least in the early part of your incarceration.
She was like my rock when I first went to prison because everything that I needed her to do for me, she did. If it was taking care of my kids or going trying to talk to a lawyer or just giving me the love and support and trying to keep my confidence and faith up that everything was going to be a better day.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes. We're talking about the book Tested, How 12 Wrongly Imprisoned Men Held On to Hope. With her, so two of the men profiled in the book, Christopher Scott and Billy Smith, along with co-author Dorothy Budd. I want to ask both of you, and Christopher first, how have you gentlemen avoided being angry? I mean, I can't imagine how I don't hear rage in your voices.
You know, you can't waste your time on being angry because that'll destroy your life, because being angry is something that you can't control. And you want to be in control of your life now, because for so long you had other people controlling your every move. So now, you know, we just try to live right. And now the positive thing about it is where I was able to come home, still was kind of young. I'm 40, but still kind of young. And I was able to send both of my kids to school now. You know, both of them go to the college that got me out of prison, which is University of Texas. Mm-hmm. You know, from the negative thing, we just try to make everything else about our life very positive.
Billy, let me ask you the same question.
My first 10 years in prison on this wrongful conviction was the hardest for me because I didn't have any connection with outside people. I only had one sister that stayed in touch with me. And having my freedom taken away from me like it did, I had to remain hopeful that one day I would get out and something would happen. But if I had held on to the anger and the rage that was inside of me, I never would have survived.
Dorothy, you're a former prosecutor. Talk to us a little bit about what made it so easy for wrongful convictions to happen.
Well, I think what happens is I doubt that any police officer wakes up in the morning and says, what I want to do today is if there's a crime in my neighborhood on my beat, I'm going to go pick the wrong man. Because it goes without saying that if you pick the wrong man, that means the actual criminal is still out there. That said, if within our system, and I don't think it's just a problem in Dallas, I think there's cases from all over the country, if the highest standard of identifying suspects, bringing them in, having eyewitness lineups, making sure that nothing is tainted in how you point out to a witness, you know, is this the person that did it? In Chris Scott's case, you know, the widow who has just watched her husband be shot is walked by and shown Chris Scott in handcuffs and essentially ask, that's the man that shot your husband, isn't it? Well, we know that that's not the best way to do a lineup and find a suspect. So what happens is, you know, one mistake's made and then the system begins to roll and before you know it, an innocent man's in prison.
I wonder, as a spiritual leader yourself, what have you learned about faith from this whole experience and how these men were able to free themselves of the anger they had and move on with their lives?
I think what I've learned that was so interesting to me and what makes this book transcend just being a book about prison or even a book about wrongful conviction is that these men are examples that each one of us can use any time in our life when we feel like we've gotten to a dead end or we're stuck. These men were literally physically stuck in 5x9 cells with nowhere to turn, and yet they found a way to hold on and to find resources within themselves, even when they felt like they had no options. And I think that's inspirational for anybody at any point in their lives.
Christopher, you've been out just over a year, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Are you and Brandy still together? Are you feeling less institutionalized?
Yes, I feel less institutionalized now. You know, when I first got out, it was kind of hard because I was scared to, like, drive cars. And when I got locked up, things were so different. We had VCR tapes. Now we have DVDs and the cell phones and the credit cards to go get your gas and whatever. It was kind of a hard transition to get through. But the course of me and Brandy, we're still friends. And you never know about, you know, what the future holds. Mm-hmm. You know, we still remain friends at this time, and the love is still there. It's just about putting it back together again.
Billy, how are you doing these days? How long have you been free?
I've been out 4 years now. I met a beautiful young lady, and We got married September 19th.
Congratulations.
2009, and we just celebrated our first wedding anniversary September 19th this year. We're having a good time. I'm just going on with my life. I'm not angry, thank God for that, because I could never have a successful marriage if I was a man running around with a lot of anger and hate. It's because, you know, anger hurts. It really hurts you. It takes away from you. And it's like, you know, I have something to finally start being excited about being married and having, you know, even though they're my stepchildren, but they treat me as though I'm their natural father. And, you know, just being married and having a wife, having someone there by my side that I know is there with me every day, somebody I can go home to. I can have a life, because I didn't have a life when I was in prison, because all that was taken away. If you just can't afford to hold on to hate and, you know, and rage, because it would have just destroyed me. And that's the reason why I wouldn't have. But now I'm getting to where, you know, being married and being happy is helping me to come around, because that's important, that we have somebody in our life that we can count on to be there. Because in the beginning of this thing, nobody was there for us. And that's what hurt the most, when you have to be there for so long. But today, I can actually say I'm a happy man, because, you know, I got somebody that's in my corner, you know. And so things are working out for me. I thank God for Dorothy and, you know, getting us together, because it helped us to further continue to have a bond. You know, as a group of us exonerees here in Dallas now, we stick together. We stay together. We're in contact at least once or twice a week. We're going to talk to each other, because, you know, we've been there, we've done that, and we're our best friends.
Christopher Scott and Billy Smith are both profiled in the book Tested, How 12 Wrongly Imprisoned Men Held On to Hope, and Reverend Dorothy Budd is a co-author of that book. They all joined us from Dallas, Texas. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us on the show today.
Finally today, the city of Chicago has lost one of its most prolific cultural leaders. Margaret Burroughs, an artist, poet, educator, and founder of cultural institutions, died yesterday at the age of 95. Burroughs founded the DuSable Museum of African American History nearly 50 years ago, as well as a 70-year-old Southside Community Center. President Barack Obama said in a statement that he and the First Lady were saddened by Burroughs' passing. He said she was admired for her contribution to American culture. I'm joined now by Lonnie Bunch with the Smithsonian National Museum of American History and Culture. Welcome to Tell Me More.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I have to say, I have remembered that museum from my childhood. She started it in her house. When she decided to create and find funding for it, there couldn't have been much else of that going on in the country. How important was it?
Well, what's crucially important about Margaret Burroughs is she is part of a generation of people who basically realized that African-American culture, its art, its history, needed not only to be preserved through people's stories and passing on of tradition, but they needed to be preserved in institutions.
I think a lot of people don't know who Margaret Burroughs is, and they think of her as only a Chicago figure. Why is she important nationally?
Well, I think that, first of all, Margaret was just a gifted artist. Her work is in many of the great collections around the country and around the world. But also, Margaret was somebody who basically found a way to marry your Americanness with your Africanness. And so she was able to, in her house and later in DuSable, bring together African art and African culture with the American experience, and helped Black Americans develop this sense of who they are. And from a national point of view, Margaret was really one of the leaders in creating the African American Museums Association, which is really an important organization that encourages and supports the preservation of culture around the country. And Margaret was the leader.
And this all started with her own personal collection of art at her home, right?
Yes, Margaret always told the story of how she ran into some school children and they didn't know anything about their heritage. In fact, they were a little, you know, embarrassed, making jokes about Africa. And so she brought them into her house and said, look at this artwork. Is this the artwork of a people to be embarrassed about? And from there, it led her to creating what I think is one of the oldest African-American museums in the country.
We'd be remiss if we didn't discuss her prowess as an artist in her own right.
What I love about Margaret is she was a gifted artist. She was a great leader. But she recognized that first and foremost, the love of the culture and her desire to express it through her poetry, through her art, was really what was her great love.
Tell me about how she was as a person. You've known her for a long time.
I first met Margaret Burroughs when I was this young curator in California in 1984. And I had just opened a big exhibition on the history of blacks in the Olympics. And, you know, I thought I was pretty good. And I walked into a conference and she said, "So you're this Lonnie Bunch I've heard about. Sit down with me and let's see if you're any good." And she literally sort of asked me 15 questions, teased my attitude about history and culture, and I realized that in that half hour we spent together, I got years worth of lessons. She was tough, she was opinionated, but it came out of a love to make sure that we all understood what it meant to be black, what it meant to be a descendant of Africa, and what it meant to be an American.
Lonnie Bunch is director of the Smithsonian Institute's National Museum of African American History and Culture. He joined us by phone to talk about the late Margaret Burroughs from the DuSable Museum in Chicago. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And that's our program for today. To read my essay for this week's Can I Just Tell You, go to our website, npr.org, click on Programs, and then Tell Me More. I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.